Welcome to the Something More podcast with me, Jamie Haxby, Steve Carmer, and Josh Fox.
You know, in such a crazy time of change and uncertainty, where all of our values have been flipped upside down, we're going to explore what it means to be truly human.
We are looking at what it means to live fully human with identity, security, and purpose.
And we're going to do that by interviewing loads of different people about their stories, the connection that they have with God.
To find out, in their own life, how have they found something more in relation to understanding and knowing who God is?
It's just evangelism. It's the grand egalitarian thing. Because, you know, we don't need a platform. You know, we're all, I think, in agreement of, you know, how the celebrity culture that's permeated contemporary evangelicalism. And I mentor young guys who are particularly high, you know, what they want to go into ministry. And what they want is they want to speak at Spring Harvest, you know, because, and we shouldn't be surprised at that, because actually we've cultivated that. We've actually cultivated the success within our particular niche of Christianity is to be on a platform in front of several thousand people with a microphone.
Good evening and a really warm welcome to night two of Future of the Church Lessons from Lockdown. My name's Nay Dawson and I'm here tonight with Becca King. Becca Sweet even, sorry. She did get married, honestly.
Return to my old name.
Becca, just introduce yourself. Tell us what life has been like in lockdown for you.
Yeah, sure. Hi everyone, my name's Becca Sweet. I live in Brighton, so by the sunny beach, love living in Brighton. I live with my husband, Dan, and I've got two roles. So I work for a charity called the Prince's Trust, which is not the Prince's Trust cut your hair off charity. It's Prince's Trust that work with youth, getting them into jobs, education or employment. And I also serve at my church in Brighton, doing a job share with Dan. So lots of people say, oh, a job share with your spouse. But yeah, it's the best thing ever. It's great. Lockdown life has been, yeah, it's been okay. I've gotten into running, which has not been that fun, but I'm appreciating the challenge. I've been doing couch to 5K. Week 9 is next week. So bringing it on. And that's the last week. And then I've been missing my friends.
Oh.
Yeah.
Well, you've got some friends here tonight. It's nice to see you. We know in the audience.
Hi, everyone.
Yeah. So I'm Nay, and I've set up Community in a Crisis as a response to the pandemic. We've been helping churches get online, putting on training events, and it's been really wonderful to see what God has been doing across the world, and particularly looking in Europe about how God has been speaking to us during lockdown, what he's been doing in our churches, how he's been changing us and shaping it. But as a working mom, it's not easy, is it? My working space tonight is about less than a meter. My children built a massive den in our living room for the whole day. And they said, Mum, you can't come for your meeting tonight. So I've tiny little space to be near the internet provider. It's not easy, is it, as working parents from home? But we've got a fantastic panel this evening, so we're going to introduce them one at a time and you'll get to know them. Please keep popping your questions and your thoughts the comments box and we'll try and respond to those as best possible through the evening. So our first panelist is Greg. Hopefully he'll be coming in fairly soon. Hey Greg.
Hi
Greg.
Hi. Welcome Hi. To our room. It's really great to meet you for the first time tonight. I've heard lots about you from lots of good friends.
Likewise, Nay. Nice to meet you.
Thanks, Greg. So, Greg is, now I've just got all confused what you are. Greg works at Wycliffe as the Director of Ministerial Training and the Dean of the Wesley Centre for Missional Engagement. So, Greg, just tell us a bit what that means and also what life has been like in lockdown for you.
Yeah, for those who don't speak Anglicanese, we love our big guys. Don't we? I'm only a reverend, you know, whereas we have very reverend, most reverend, we have all kinds of, anyway, we'll get there. But what does it mean? Basically, I'm the practical theologian. Wycliffe Hall is a theological college. It's a seminary, so it trains women and men for ordained ministry, particularly in the Church of England. It's also a college of the University of Oxford. And so I'm the applied theologian. So I oversee the three departments. I oversee the ministerial training and formation department, and my specialisms within that are homiletics, which is preaching, and evangelism, missiology, apologetics, that kind of thing.
Amazing. Thank you, Greg.
And what are we doing in lockdown?
Yeah, life in lockdown. Sorry. How's life in lockdown?
Well, do you know, I met with my boss today, the principal of Wycliffe, socially distanced, of course, on two sides of a park bench. It's funny how we always feel we've got to say that. Have you noticed everybody goes there? I met someone, socially distanced. We feel we've got to justify it. Anyway, he was concerned about me because he knows I'm a sort of extrovert and activist. And so I have been climbing the walls a little bit. And I'm glad that we've got this semi-leniency that's going on now. So to be honest, you know, it's been a difficult time for me. But some new, great creative things. I told my boss today I've started baking my own bread.
Oh, wow. What type of bread?
Well, it's a bread maker. So I feel a bit of a cheat. I just throw everything in. But there is some baking while we speak. There is some keto bread. Keto bread is baking.
You've got a really tidy room behind you, Greg. Could you tell us a bit about it?
Yeah, I can tell you. And I've been painting as well. So we had a competition at Wycliffe for Pentecost. That was my, can you see that?
Oh, wow.
That was my contribution.
Great.
Basically, it's supposed to be like power from on high, but my wife said it should be called Bugs Bunny Escaping from a House Fire.
I like her. Brilliant.
It is like a rabbit, isn't it? It's like a rabbit running out of a house fire. So anyway,
that's great, Greg. Should we move on to our next guest?
Yeah.
We'd love to welcome Kay Morgan Gurr into our room. And Becca's going to introduce. No, I'm going to introduce Kay. Sorry, everything's gone wrong tonight. So this is my friend Kay. Really warm welcome. I hope you're slightly more sensible than Greg. Kay and I have known each other for a while through the Passion for Evangelism Network and Network for Female Evangelists, which is really exciting and dynamic. But Kay has many hats in life. She's the co-founder of the Additional Needs Alliance. She's the chair of the Children's Matter Coalition. She's also the Additional Needs Advisor on Disability to Spring Harvest and on the Council for Evangelical Alliance. So Kay, really warm welcome to you this evening. Maybe you could just share a bit about what life has been like in lockdown for you.
Oh, well, I'm one of those many people that are vulnerable. So I've not been allowed out. Apparently I'm allowed out for a short time now, but I'm not risking it. It's been busy and quiet at the same time. It's just myself and my husband at home. So yeah, making videos, but still don't like making videos, all sorts of things going on. The plus side is being disabled. No one's tried to lay hands on me to heal me in 12 weeks. It's amazing.
Well, that's one of the issues we're going to talk about tonight, isn't it? So thank you so much for being here, being open and honest. We're really excited to hear what you've got to say on that issue, particularly tonight. So our final guest is Jamie Haxby, and Becca is going to introduce Jamie.
I am indeed. Hello, Jamie.
Good evening. Hello. Thank you, Becca. Becca Sweet.
Thank you for getting my name right. How very kind.
Someone told me.
I did go to her wedding, so I should have known the answer to that.
It's all good. We were going to have Mez McConnell on the panel this evening, but sadly due to sickness we can't have him, but we can have Jamie. So thank you so much for being with us. We're really grateful. Jamie splits his time for Friends International and Hope Church Lancaster, developing creative ways to do mission in a post-Christian age, which I think is a very unusual title. So congratulations for that.
I made it up myself, to be honest.
Did you? How exciting. Yeah. Jamie's married to Alicia and father to Flora. And he loves the outdoors, his family, and getting people passionate about the kingdom of God. And during lockdown, you've been just looking at ways to do church innovatively, including setting up a support line for vulnerable people in Lancaster that has now incredibly helped over 1,000 people and attracted attention, including a Point of Light Award from Boris Johnson himself. Congratulations, that's incredible.
Thanks, it was quite a surprise.
How did he give it to you? Was it over Zoom? Did you just pop up?
I keep making a really inappropriate joke that Dominic Cummings drove up to give it to me, which I should probably stop saying. But they basically got in touch with me over email, but I'm still awaiting my letter, so that's going to come in the post, hopefully at some point soon.
I hope you frame it.
Yeah, I will. I'll put it on my wall. Yeah.
Good. What's life been like in lockdown for you?
Yeah, you know, I was joking earlier that this is the sort of thing that I sort of time that I thrive in and love in a very weird sort of way. I don't brush over the fact that it's been dreadful for lots of people, but I think I'm someone that does well in crisis and is quite adaptable and good at starting things. So I think early on I was very, very busy getting lots of things off the ground and just that was for me a really exciting time to be doing ministry. So it's been busy and then things have calmed down a little bit in the last few weeks, and I've enjoyed spending lots of time with family as well, and we've built a pond in our garden done some baking the proper way without a bread maker.
Well done.
And I've not done any drawings or paintings of the spirit on my phone.
You can learn from Greg. He's a pro.
After tonight, I'll do my version and send it over to you, Greg.
I'll give you a few tips.
Thank you,
Grace. So thanks so much for all your comments that are coming in. We were asking the question, what have you missed in church in lockdown? And people have been writing things like, missed actual meeting actual people, but great to see old friends from other churches. Mm-hmm. The most enjoyed being able to visit churches all over the UK with access to BSL, which our church doesn't have. Hugh says, big mood, there's no real substitute for eating together when it comes to fellowship. So thanks so much for your comments. Please keep sending your comments in through the evening, and we'd love to start getting your questions. So just take a moment to think about what your questions are for this evening for our panelists, for Jamie, for Greg, for Kay, and pop them in. And as soon as they start coming in, we'll be responding to those. But maybe one of our first questions to our panelists could be this. Do you think there are going to be things that we look back at from pre-COVID-19 and think, I can't believe we ever did that? So Greg, do you want to go first? Kick us off.
Yeah, I think the 40-minute sermon, because you know, classically in our evangelical churches, we have this big monologic discourse, which is usually 40 minutes, that I used to give them at St. Michael Belfry. That's where I was on the staff before I moved to Oxford. And St. Aldate's Oxford, which is the church I worship at now, they have it there. But what we've done, in like a lot of churches, for online church during lockdown at St. Aldate's, the church has shrunk from 40 to 20 minutes. And even then, it's in 2 10-minute blocks. So, you know, 10-minute block and then something else, and magazine format, and then 10 minutes. And, you know, I think it works so much better having it in two sections. And what we've realised, I think, pretty quickly, is that long monologic sermons just don't work online. It's got to be soundbite. It's got to be snappy. And I think that's something we'll look back and we think, gosh, why did we do that? Why didn't we jettison that form of preaching earlier?
Mm.
Do you think there's anything we lose, Greg? I mean, obviously, like Facebook Live events, talks have got to be between 12 and 15 minutes. We know it makes sense for interaction and engagement, but do you think we lose anything in having short snappiness in our talks?
Well, I think, you know, we can have soundbite and you know, build rapport to connect with people, as well as theological depth. One isn't antithetical to the other. So as long as it's not having shortened, you know, having snappy without any theological depth. But I think the thing of separating, so even if people want to preach long, by separating it into two bits, you know, there's that recognition that people's attention span generally isn't as long as sometimes we like to think. Mm-hmm. And also, for the more in-depth thing, we can move those things midweek, you know, in terms of the role of small groups, you know, doing inductive Bible study, that kind of thing. That can be the context, perhaps, rather than seeing the Sunday shop window is the place where we've got to do all the stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks, Greg, so much. Kay, Jamie, do you want to jump in with
other... Yeah, I was just wondering whether there's a sort of more underlying thing to what Greg is saying as well, in that one of the things that I really hope that we lose in this time is this real emphasis on what happens on the stage and what happens at the front. And church is very much about rows and not circles. Because I think it depends how people have done church during this time, but for the way that we have done it is live on Facebook, and we've quickly realized that if you want to do well live on Facebook, you have to generate lots of engagement and get people commenting and get people involved in the discussion, a bit like we're doing this evening. And that then means that the emphasis is more upon it being a conversation, and changes the way that you do it. So we're asking more questions to the audience, we're doing more kind of podcast style interview type things, and drawing people kind of into the discussion, pulling them onto the screen, and I think that I really hope is something that is there to stay, that it becomes, you know, I think it depends. For some people, I think it's been different, and obviously they've done a pre-recorded service, and maybe that kind of community engagement has not been there, but I hope in some ways it's disseminated that upfront stage thing. Because the reality is, you know, if I want a really well produced, I can't remember, it might even have stolen this from you, Nate, but if I want, you know, the best preaching and the best worship, I could log on and I can get Matt Chandler, and then I can get, you know, Elevation doing my worship, and I can have a fantastic Sunday morning. But the thing that I can't find is actual genuine community. And so that has had to be the emphasis of what we've done online, is somehow creating that in the sermon, in the worship, in everything that we do midweek, to make it generally focused on real engagements with people online in a meaningful way as possible. So yeah, I hope we drop the stage as the center of importance. Circles, not rows.
Yeah.
Sorry, Bethy, you go for it.
How have you seen people engage with that? Like, what opportunities has that given people to be involved in the service?
Good question. I mean, mainly just as we're doing tonight, you know, we're using this kind of similar platform that we're using tonight to just get people to comment in and ask questions and be a part of the discussion. So I mean, we're not an expert at this, obviously, because we've never been in a pandemic before and done church online. So we're just learning the same way as everybody else. So don't in any way, shape or form think that we have got this sorted at all. And I think there's obviously better ways to do it. And it'd be interesting to talk and hear, particularly later from Kay's experience of obviously having done this for longer, you know, to then move that question further to think, well, how do we go beyond that and actually start doing church online in a way that disciples people really, really well, where we see church online as, you know, maybe a campus of our ministry, which is something, you know, I stole that from Steve, our pastor, which is a language that he's always used. You know, how can we make our online presence a campus of the church that's reaching out to people and providing discipleship? And those questions are really difficult to answer. And there's loads of pitfalls and things to work through, and difficult questions, but we're just at the start of trying to work out some of the answers to those things, really. So that doesn't really answer your question, but hopefully helps.
No, that's fine. And Kay, you're not at the start of working this out, are you? Amongst many friends, you've been doing this for decades.
Yeah, a lot of my colleagues have. I personally am very privileged in the fact that I can go to church. But I have many, many friends that have not been able to do this for a long, long, long time. Yeah, they're saying to the rest of us going, oh, no, we're going into lockdown. Oh, no, we've got to do church outside of a building. They're just going, welcome to my world. This is my life. I can't get into a church. I can't physically get in. I can't emotionally cope with it. It's too loud. You know, I've much appreciated the worship now more than when I was actually in a church building. It's far more accessible. And these are the guys that can be telling us that, you know, actually the shorter sermon is much easier. You know, there are people with learning disabilities where that split into two sermon for 10 minutes each is far more accessible for them. There is just so much we can learn from that community, my community, to teach us so much more about how to do church better, both online and offline. It's being Jesus in the community, not in a building.
Yeah, thank you, Kay. Becca, have you got any questions or come back from the comments? We've had a few comments come in.
I can't see my screen because of the sun, so I'm going to go sort that out and then I'll be back.
So, Greg, we've had a few come back on your 40.
Yeah.
Point. I don't know if you can see them as well. So, Hugh,
I can see them.
Do you want to answer Hugh's question? Can you see that there?
Yeah, shall I? David's first because David mentions first about.
Oh yeah, go for it. Good friend Dave McNee.
Yeah, David. Basically, so obviously I was being a little bit provocative to start with, so obviously it paid off, which is good. So in terms of David, he basically said, well, what's the dynamic then that, you know, we can listen to Matt Chandler, et cetera, and these great expositors before, but actually not online? Well, I think the simple answer to that is that when you've got people in church, I mean, if we were hearing people live before, it's a captive audience. And the fact is online, the whole thing is predicated around soundbite, isn't it? So we know from research that lots of younger people, millennials, they click on things literally for a few seconds. If they decide within 20 seconds whether they like it, then they click off. And so sometimes I laugh slightly because some of these pastors who are broadcasting, you know, their figures that normally I have 300 in my church and now I've got 1,000. How many have actually been there all the way through and not just literally clicked on and clicked off? And so I think we live in much more of a soundbite culture, you know, a bit more of a visual culture, and communication has changed radically in the past few decades, and yet our monologic sermon hasn't. So I'm not in any way suggesting we don't take seriously preaching or teaching. I'm actually lecturer in homiletics at Wycliffe, so I'd be out of a job if I was doing down preaching. You know, I believe in preaching, to quote a famous book of yesteryear, but I think, you know, how we do it is a different issue. Go on.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I think maybe part of the problem is obviously that emphasis on the stage on Sunday means that you cling on to those 40 minutes because they are your most precious time of discipleship that you have with your congregation, and you hang on to every second that you've got because that's all you've got. And that is obviously a problem. And that is why perhaps people feel quite strongly we need to cling on to those 40 minutes, because obviously people need input and people need discipling. But it's, you know, maybe the problem is more the fact that we're just focused so much on what happens on Sunday morning.
And that was part of my point as well, is that actually we don't need to do it all then. It's not all, we don't need to stack all our teaching into 40 minutes on a Sunday in a monologic format. Shall I look at Hugh's question then? So Hugh says, I must disagree with Greg on the 40 minute sermon point. Looking at the success of ministries like Mike Winger on YouTube, lots of people who pursue that level of detail, but he agrees with the de-emphasis, which is what we've just talked about there. And so just to reiterate there, I'm not in any way saying that we need to go gospel light or go light on our teaching. Absolutely not. It's that particular format that I'm talking about. And actually the separation thing, it was interesting, the point that was just made earlier, in terms of there are lots of people for whom, you know, 40 minutes of monologue is not conducive. They just glaze, you know, they don't listen. They, you know, it's not a conducive way of communicating. And the separation thing, like we've done at my church and many churches, I think that alone, just to split it into two alone is a great idea. Even if you want to just do 20 minutes, 20 minutes, just to split it into two and put some other stuff in between, actually that in itself would be an improvement.
Mm.
Thank you. I'm going to move us on. I can see that people are commenting on the 40-minute sermons, the pros and the cons. You know, they're a big part of what we're used to and a big part of what we're learning about.
Yeah.
Got another question here that's just, the internet has granted a level of accessibility to church that we've never seen before. I think some people worried that this was a bad thing, but what effect do you think this increased accessibility has actually had? Kay, why don't we start with you?
The accessibility has been amazing for the majority, but not for all.
Okay.
It's been great in so many aspects, in the fact that we are making things shorter. We're helping people to understand a little bit better. We're actually looking at church as family, where the whole family can belong, regardless of age, regardless of ability, regardless of whether you can listen for that amount of time. Or, you know, I don't have a learning disability, but listening to a 40-minute sermon without my knitting is an absolute pain. So I've actually enjoyed being able to knit while I'm listening to a sermon. But there's other things to think of as well, because it's more than just the preach. It's the whole ambience of the church. So the noise, the movement, the light. A lot of our parents in the Additional Needs Alliance have said that their children are engaging with church more than they've ever been able to before, because they haven't got loads of people in their face. There's lot everything else that's going on, the noise and everything. And yet these are the families that haven't been to church in years, because the church has said, we're not for you, find somewhere more accessible, because they're the ones creating the noise, because they can't cope with the noise. It's a bit more complicated than that, but you know what I mean. So when people say people aren't going to come back to church if we do it all online, I don't think that's the case. What I'm seeing online is a very vocal group saying, I can't wait to get back into my building. But a quieter group saying, actually, I'm finding this far more accessible. I go to church, but I will choose to be offline. But it's also encouraged other people to find a more accessible church so they can go to church, because they're missing that face-to-face interaction. So we can't make a sweeping statement. It's a swings and roundabouts thing. So you may find that you've got more people in the church rather than less, but more disabled people in the church, because all of a sudden they've found out that you're accessible.
Jamie, Greg, any thoughts off the back of that?
Yeah, I was just thinking, you know, and in our church, we've seen people who have come in who have basically engaged online first and then joined the church afterwards, or, you know, in some cases, who have been just watching sermons and churches online. And then, you know, we had one student, and she'd been watching church services online, not really considered herself a Christian before. And then having watched it online for a period, then kind of like found the courage to come along in real life. And I wonder whether that could be a really kind of exciting trend as well that we might start to see. And thinking of people that are suffering with all sorts of things, you know, and reasons why people might struggle coming into church. Some of that is anxiety, which we know is rife in our culture. And loads of people are struggling with it, and they need the gospel in order to, you know, to help them out of that. And for them to be able to access online first is a brilliant way to first start to engage with them. You know, I stole this from someone else. They said, you know, we're just kind of catching up with the online dating scene. You know, you kind of meet someone online first and try it out and see if you like it, and then move to real life if things seem to be working well. You know, and I think we've certainly started to see that a little bit before lockdown, and I think that's only going to increase. Yeah, it's, you know, it's really exciting possibilities, and we might talk about this in a minute. I'll see where Greg goes, but I think there needs to be a word of caution as well there as well. I think that you know, it feels like in 2006 everybody was like, delete your Facebook account, it was made by Satan, just get out of there. And now everyone's like, show me where to live stream. I need to get involved. And this kind of rhetoric, you know, that Facebook and YouTube and Instagram is the new Roman roads. It's the new paper press. This is the new thing that's going to bring about the next revolution in culture, the next revolution in Christianity. Now, I'm sure that there is much truth in that. There is loads of truth in that, but it is also fraught with danger. We cannot underestimate the power that these places hold in terms of formation. And obviously this depends where you're doing church. If you're doing church on Zoom, it might not be that difficult. But, you know, I said a little while ago, I think if you're doing church on Facebook, you're basically doing it in a temple worshipping a foreign god. And, you know, I think it was Mark Sayers said that, you know, the danger when Christians go to a non-Christian culture is that they colonize it. The danger when Christians go to a post-Christian culture like Facebook, like Instagram, is that they get colonized. And that we are in some senses luring our people into a place where they're going to get trapped by something that's incredibly powerful. And, you know, you kind of have to realize that on Facebook, you are not a customer or a consumer. You are the harvest. They are collecting your data, selling it to companies that are then manipulating you via incredibly powerful marketing so that you would worship false idols. we can't
everyone get off this now.
I know, but you can't escape the power that exists there, and that's not, you know, I do believe that we need to be here, but I think we have to be equipping people and discipling them to be able to cope within those structures, and to be able to disrupt it and distort it from the inside out. You know, if Cambridge Analytica can basically hack the social mindset for the Trump campaign or for Brexit or for whatever else they were involved with, you know, we don't really know all the details of how much effect they had, then maybe in a more ethical way, we can disrupt the social mindset to lead people back to Jesus. But, you know, I don't even know how or where to begin, but that's a question that I've been wrestling with in my mind. So I think absolutely we need to remain accessible online, but wrestle with some of those dangers as well.
Could I just input into that? You'll notice that many Christians at Lent say that they're giving up social media.
Yeah.
Yep.
So that means that all the disabled Christians that are on social media see the church get up and leave them.
Wow.
Because that is the place where they get their fellowship. It's where they learn. It's where they meet people. There needs to be a presence. I understand people want to give it up for Lent, but there's other ways of doing it.
Yeah. I think you're absolutely right, Kay. And you know, there's so many broken and hurting people that are on there. I think it's the place where the church needs to be. Absolutely. But yeah, it is difficult.
And it's wrestling with that one voice amongst many.
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
There's some good stuff being written, hasn't there, just on how you stay online in healthy ways. My favourite thing has been written by Cal Newport. He wrote a book called Digital Minimalism. And he encourages you not to give it up, because actually that doesn't really work. But he encourages you to have a detox and then thinking about what your values are and building your social media habits around your values rather than just convenience and addiction. And even just naming it has been quite helpful, thinking through that. So he's not a Christian. He's a secular computer professor in America, but he's been my standout book on social media addiction and how as a Christian to stay within this world, but just not be somebody that's so addicted that I can't see what's going on. Thanks, Kay, for that prompter. We've had some good questions from Brian Porter about discipleship, which is kind of where we're going, I guess. So let's go for Brian's question. I think it's a good in principle thing that people have access to church services and have logged into them. The issue is that it lacks relationship and discipleship. It can leave some Christians feeling like they can ease off on the job we're called and equipped for. Greg, do you want to help us out with the answer to that? Great question, Brian.
Yeah, sure. No, it is very good indeed. I think that relationship thing is the key there. That I think I'm someone who wants to be optimistic about life in general, but also about the possibilities that present us. So I think when something new happens, there's very rarely something that's good without a downside, is there? There's a positive with a downside. And there are some of us, we temperamentally, we look at the negative, some of us look at the positive. So we need balance somewhere along the line. So I think just to backtrack slightly, the accessibility thing, with my evangelist hat on, I think that's one of the positive things that it's provided. The online church that we've been doing, it's provided a way to come and see in a fairly non-threatening way that wasn't there before. So if we wanted one, Zacchaeus would be the patron saint of online church, because he wanted Jesus without being seen by Jesus. And it, just as Jamie said, it's desperately threatening to go into a church. And we don't realise, because we're so encultured into our churches. Mm-hmm. I remember a few years ago hearing a preacher who basically was using the illustration. He said, if you want the picture of what it's like to go into for a non-Christian, an unchurched person to enter a church, which is what we ask them to do all the time, it's like your average evangelical vicar going into a betting shop. You know, that would be the same sense of bewilderment. And I remember I thought I'd try it. So I'd been to a service at Southwark Cathedral in London. I had my clerical collar in. I'd never been in a betting shop before. But I went into a betting office, whatever it was, kind of was called. But I went in, and of course, with my clerical collar on, everybody looked at me. I felt like a pork fry in a bar mitzvah. And I had no idea what was going on. And I went to the bet, and they said, oh, you place a bet. It's 20p each way is the minimum bet. And I thought, well, what's each way and all this? Anyway, it felt completely disorientating, an evangelical pastor in a betting shop. And so it is completely disorientating. And so it allows people to come and see, as I say, a bit like the Saint Zacchaeus or Zacchaeus, they can actually, they can see without being seen. So mm-hmm. I think that's positive. But to circle to Brian, is therefore going forward, is that you know, the new normal, the totally overused phrase that we're all hearing, is that the new normal for how we do church? Is it on an equivalent to real church, so to speak? And I don't think it is. I actually, because I think at the heart of church is, as Brian says there, community, the relationship. And the word ecclesia literally means called out ones, it's all God's community. And I think online community is a form of community, but it's an impoverished form of community. Yep. And so I can't wait to get back. And I want to actively teach that it's an impoverished form of community. So thank God that we've got the technology now in a way that the 1918 flu pandemic we didn't have. Praise God for that. But nonetheless, it's still an impoverished form of community. And actually, the you know, God's normative best is human interaction and with one another and with Him in a gathered community. And I think we need to. I certainly, as a minister, I want to champion that while celebrating the impoverished. Champion that which is the God's normative best.
Kay, have you got anything to add to that? Thanks, Greg. I've just been so deeply moved by Kay and Tanya Marlowe and Emma Major in this period, thinking about disabilities and accessibility to church and what it means to return to a new normal, what it means to listen to the experts. So Kay, have you got any pushback on what Greg's saying or anything to add to help here?
I think first I'd just like to just pick up on the last part of Brian's comments, that leaving some Christians feeling like they can ease off. I have not seen that. I have actually seen this as a catalyst for Christians to get up and get out there and do stuff. Mm. You know, to hear last night that there were people volunteering to find food, specific foods for people with autism, because they can only eat that specific food. That's the church getting into action. It might sound stupid to a lot of people, but my heart just burst with pride when I actually heard a church was doing that. It's just great. And many actually experiencing compassion fatigue because there is just too much and they don't know what to do because they need to do something. But from an accessibility point of view, a lot of comments that I see, not just now, just all over the place, actually shows a position of privilege where, you know, we all want that sermon, we all want that to happen, we all want this to happen, without a thought to the 1 in 5 in our churches that can't do church like that. You know, church is supposed to be the place where we're welcoming to everybody. That Sunday morning where the church is gathered, before COVID, that is the place where the whole family gathers. It's not the place where we bombard with theological information. We have home groups for that. We can go and look up anybody on YouTube for that. Now online, many churches, the small churches that don't have many hits, they're achieving this. They're actually doing it. If you go hunting around for some of the evangelical churches, where most of the service is geared towards the children, but the message is equal to everybody that attends that church online, you can see the accessibility. And if we're actually thinking that big picture, put our own privilege to one side and our own preferences and say what is best for the family and the community, you'll actually find a place that'll work both online and offline. So ditch the privilege, think Jesus.
Thank you, Kay, so much. We've got some great questions coming in. Please keep them coming in. Becca, do you want to choose the next one and go for it?
Yeah, sure. Thank you, Hope Church Lancaster, for your question of what do the new digital missionaries look like and how do we train them if the future is a mixed economy? Jamie, I wonder if you could pick up on this. It links to what you were saying earlier.
Wow. Yeah, thank you, my church for asking that question, which is probably our pastor Steve, because he can never work out how to get off the page. It's a common issue that we have, but really, that's such a key question, and one that I've been thinking through, and I'm not totally sure that I have all the answers to be quite honest. But I do think we need to train people to be able to read and understand the culture, and mm-hmm. and to train them specifically in spiritual formation, and what it means to know Jesus. Because I think the danger with all of this stuff, one of the main dangers is distraction, isn't it? And that we end up being distracted to such a great extent that we don't know how to sit down and meditate on the scriptures, that we no longer know how to pray. And we know that actually, regardless of the new digital section of that question, what the missionaries look like and how do we train them, we need them to have a white hot passionate faith for Jesus, on their knees contending for prayer, contending in prayer, heartbreaking for the lost, knowing their scriptures, and just bursting at the seams to tell people the gospel and save and reach the lost. And I think that is exactly the same, you know, online, offline, those things are exactly the same. Mm-hmm. And probably even more important on the digital side of things, because of the dangers of going into that place, that they need to know who they are in Christ. They need to be secure in their identity. They need to be solid in their convictions, and be able to read and understand the cultural moment in which we live and how that's been expressed digitally. You know, I think I said last night, you know, you can't speak with spiritual authority into the culture in which we live unless you are free from the idols that are ensnaring the same culture. So we need people that are set free from the idols and the addiction to Facebook to go into Facebook and turn it upside down. Mm-hmm. How we then disciple and train people to do that is tricky, but you know it starts with all the same things that I think are familiar to us: teaching people how to love Jesus, teaching people how to form their character and how to pray and how to contemplate the scriptures and go deep with Jesus. Those things of spiritual formation, pray and read your Bible. Mm-hmm. It's a glib answer in some ways, isn't it? But also incredibly deep.
You're congratulating your own answer.
I think I am, but you know, I'd like to argue it's not my answer. That's always been the answer. I didn't come up with that one.
You are so deep, Jamie. I've always thought that.
Greg, would you like to add anything to that question? I'm also interested in how we disciple more broadly online. You know, we want to move away from this idea that the church is a building and we're looking forward to going back to it, even though we benefit from gathering with other Christians in whatever way that looks like, the people are the church, and that each one has an invaluable part to play. And how do we move people towards that whilst online?
Yes, yeah. So the earlier one, what do missionaries look like? My answer to that would be they look like the five people here. In other words, they look like every member of the church. And that's the exciting thing to me about digital evangelism. Mm. It's the grand egalitarian thing, because you know, we don't need a platform. You know, we're all I think in agreement of, you know, how the celebrity culture that's permeated contemporary evangelicalism, and I you know, mentor young guys who are particularly, you know, what they want to go into ministry, and what they want is they want to speak at Spring Harvest, you know, because and we shouldn't be surprised at that, because actually we've cultivated that, we've actually cultivated that success within our particular niche of Christianity is to be on a platform in front of several thousand people with a microphone. I was thinking the other day on my Facebook, how many of my Facebook friends they've got their profile shot, which is them with a microphone like this, and it's saying something, isn't it? When you put, sorry if you have Jamie, I've done it.
Anyway,
if you've got your profile shot,
I've tried my microphone. You're saying,
look, I've made it. I've got a microphone. You know, and that's the great thing with Facebook or whatever platform you want to choose. It's the great equalizer that all of us who are on social network, we all have a voice, and we can all be apostolos. We can be sent into cyber world with all its potential dangers as well, to actually be witnesses in the world. So that's, I'm excited about that. But the second part, in terms of discipleship, one of the things I think is that the lockdown thing, again, another possibly provocative thing, is the lockdown thing has exposed the shallowness of a lot of discipleship. So I think there is a lot of shallow discipleship in the church, and lockdown has exposed it, because what it's done is it's knocked our supports away. And so for many Christians, I think, even though we would admit it, they exist on on you know, Sunday Christianity. So if they're honest, they're not really praying, not really seeking God, you know, through the week, you know, they feel guilty about it, whatever. And so they go in, they get their Sunday fix, and that's it. Well, that's been knocked away, or it's been changed, not been knocked away, it's been changed by the online version. But it's, as I say, it's not quite the same, is it? So I think the lockdown has exposed, the shallowness of a lot of discipleship, because it's knocked down a lot of the things we did rely on. And I think it is, you know, the bands, the stages, the buildings, you know, for me in the Anglican tradition, the beautiful medieval buildings, whatever it is, you know, it's been stripped back. And I think that's a good thing, because I think those things which are good can even become idols. So idols are not just secular idols, are they? You know, things within our church tradition can become idols, our cathedrals or whatever it might be, and or whatever the kind of Pentecostal equivalent is. And all this thing has been, it's all been blown away. And actually, ultimately, the question that the Lord's been asking is, you know, who are you in relation to me? What, you know, in terms of, you know, are you walking with intimacy, in terms of knowing me and hearing my voice and reading the scriptures? It's got us back to the rudimentary stuff of discipleship that sadly has been neglected.
That's really good. And actually, Jamie's written a cracking blog on that, haven't you, Jamie? Why don't you just tell us a bit about your thoughts from what we can learn from the persecuted church, particularly from the church in Iran, about discipleship, about, you know, without a building, without all the kind of stuff that we've got, how they can be church in quite a profound way. You could share a bit.
Yeah, so I mean, I've not really thoughts of my own, but I stole them from a film. So if you've not watched Sheep Among Wolves, Volume 2, have any of you guys seen that?
Sadly, no.
You need to go and watch it. It's an incredibly powerfully moving film about the story of the underground church in Iran. Just before I get there, actually, a couple of things to just point out that might be really useful. There is, in terms of discipleship on Facebook, these are just little tools that are worth knowing about. So there's a lady called Nonna Jones. She's head of faith for Facebook, and she's developing some tools which can be used for discipleship on Facebook. So she's developed a mentoring scheme within Facebook groups. So you can basically set up people that want to be mentored in a particular thing, and then you can set up people that are able to mentor in a particular thing, and then they can get joined together on Facebook and kind of set goals and mentor each other in that way. So that's kind of one of the, and there's a few other things that she's done as well that are quite interesting. So I don't think that's the whole and complete answer, but they're kind of things that are worth knowing about. They're tools that are out there that can be used. And it's just exciting to think that Facebook are thinking, how can we use this platform better for churches? So that's interesting. But sorry, coming back to the Iran thing, one of the things that is just shows how far wrong perhaps we have gone, and the reason why they say that in Iran the church is growing faster than anywhere else in the world is because they really focus on making disciples and not converts. And I think so much of our evangelism and mission is about the big meeting with the one point of decision, pray the prayer, make a decision. And I'm guilty of that. I love those meetings, and I organize them and speak at them. They're like my favorite thing ever. I love those. And you know, let's not knock it completely. I've seen people become Christians in that moment in a really convincing and meaningful way that have gone on to love and serve Jesus. But what they're doing in Iran is they are saying, before you even get, and this is partly because of the context they're working in, before you even get to that point, we're going to make a discipleship making movement where we actually teach people what it looks like to follow Jesus before we've even told them who Jesus is. So we start to teach them in his ways and form them spiritually. And they say, you know, once they've got this is what they say in the film, you know, once we've got a group of two or three people and we're together having that conversation of what it means to follow Jesus, and we're starting to talk about the ways of Jesus, they consider that the start of a church plant. I think that's crazy, isn't it? They're not even Christians, and they'd consider that the start of a church plant just because they're teaching them in the ways to follow Jesus. I think that's just cool. Something incredibly beautiful and freeing and very messy, admittedly, about that. But I don't know. Where to even begin with that in a way, but you know, there's something so right about what it is that they're doing that's incredibly freeing and unafraid and bold and just captivating and beautiful. You need to watch the film, really.
Great, thanks so much, Jamie. Becca, have you got any questions?
Just looking through these, Greg started to answer this a little bit, but I wonder if we could ask this to Kay. So thank you, Miles, for your question. It says,
as we slowly start thinking about transition back to physical services over the next 6 months, how do you think we can best continue the positives of digital church without the distractions of barrage of day-to-day church admin? Or I guess, how can we include people that may not be able to come back to physical church?
Oh, that is such a big question. We need to keep it going. We really do. Especially when you consider that there's going to be an awful lot of elderly people that are not going to be able to come back for a while. Mm. So we have got to do that. I appreciate the busyness. Admin just takes over sometimes. But sometimes we just need to find someone that will take a champion, if you like, that the digital champion that will take that bit on board. So it's not all dumped on the pastor. We dump everything on the pastor or the vicar, don't we? So just finding someone that is really into this. And if I can challenge you that use disabled people on this as well. There are plenty of people with disabilities that are really, really good at this digital stuff. Mm. So find someone that can do it and do that. But along with that, the distractions are quite often the noise of a vocal minority, aren't they? Yeah, we want church like this, we want that to happen there and everything. Mm. We need to deal with that. And I'm actually hoping that lockdown has actually changed some of that, where there's a lot of pressure put on. So over the next 6 months, I would say put somebody in place that's good at the digital stuff, give it them to do. Don't put it all on one person. Find other people that can deal with the pastoral issues that are going to be with people that are not at church, that can't get to church. Just have a team that can cover every single point. Now, I acknowledge that that is really, really hard if you're the one person in a rural parish. In fact, it's basically impossible because you've got three churches and it's just you. Mm-hmm. But maybe this is a time to start growing and discipling your congregation, your 80-year-olds, your 90-year-olds, to actually be thinking about how we can be being more helpful in doing stuff. I mean, there's loads of ideas out there on that one.
Mm. Yeah, I think you're so right, Kay. And I've seen an amazing thing happen in lockdown where God is raising up dormant leaders. So people had leadership gifts but just never had the opportunity to use them. In the work with Community in Crisis, I've just seen loads of examples across the UK. So Vivian Wells, for example, in Dorset, there's no vicar, they've got six parish churches, and her and some friends are now running church on Zoom for these six parish churches. And she's got a son and a grandchild, so you can guess her age. What I'm saying is there's just amazing people that God's raising up, and we wouldn't necessarily expect them to run the tech team for six parish churches, but people are out there, and I'm one of those that God has given new opportunities or a new voice to in this time. So yeah, Kay, I think you're completely right on that.
If I can turn this on its head, you know, we're actually looking at it as we get back into church, how do we do unto those others that can't get into church?
Yeah,
but we've got leaders that can't get into the church because of their own health. You know, they may have had cancer, they may have had a transplant. There may be people that have never had a chance to lead before because they can't get into the church. Mm-hmm. But they have a gift of preaching.
Yeah.
They have a gift of reading, of praying. Can we turn it on its head and say it's not just a case of live streaming out? Why can't we live stream the sermon in by someone that can't get into the church? Why can't the prayers be led by the person that is too ill, or is it too much risk to go into the church? So it's not just going one way. We've got to think of it going the other way as well. People that can't come into the church can still serve.
Thank you, Kay, so much. It's so helpful having you on the panel. I'm so grateful for all that you've taught me the last 10 weeks or so and what we're learning tonight. We've got a great question from Dave here. How do you think people's priorities will have been changed by the pandemic and how it's affected our lives? How will those changed priorities affect church? Mm. Coupled with that, someone else was saying, Jamie, we'd love to hear your kind of future thoughts for your own church. Jamie, do you want to start? I hope that's not someone from your church, but just go for that one to begin
with. Yeah, I could try and couple those two things in together, really. I was reflecting on this earlier that... And this couples back to the kind of question we were asking last night as well, which is fascinating me at the moment, is this going to be a moment where we see the secular narrative disruptive of hyper-individualism and I don't know, all the kind of things that we've seen going on at the moment in terms of approaches to truth. And, you know, we could talk about that forever. Are we going to see some of that disrupted as well? And is the things that people place their priorities in life going to change? And I guess we can't know for sure, but I really hope that they will, that there won't be, that people will start to want to settle on something else that's going to bring significance into their life. And I was thinking about it this way earlier, reading this in a book that I was reading this morning, you know, that only in the West has history focused upon progress because of the gospel. If you look at history in other places, and the way people view history, it's more cyclical. They imagine that things have gone round and round and round. But because of the scriptures, there's this been belief that there is progress, because all the way through the scriptures, we're moving towards the presence of God and moving back to that place of walking in the cool of the day. And that's the kind of end point of history to which the whole thing has been moving towards. But now that God has been removed from the picture in Europe, instead of moving towards a picture of the presence of the Father, we're moving towards a human utopia, a humanist utopia, which is, and that picture is fastly running out of steam, I suppose, you know. And I know Chris last night was saying, you know, he's not sure whether some of this stuff has had that much of an impact, but I think that for some people, you know, in terms of street philosophy and street understanding of these things, I don't know if people can ever vocalize it, but I think that there's been punch after punch after punch, and it's been the financial crisis, it's been Hollywood and the Me Too movement, it's been now coronavirus, it's been Cambridge Analytica. All the things that we thought were wonderful about this humanistic utopia that we've created have been just taken a massive blow. And I think we're fast running out of ideas as to what this progress is that we're moving towards. And I think now is the time for the church to rise up and show and say, you know, hey, this is all about the presence of God. That is what we're made for, and that's where we want to be, and that's what we want our strategy to be as a church, you know, that this isn't about trying to follow that same idol of progress within our church buildings and put on a better show on a Sunday morning, but actually, like the Israelites in the wilderness, following the presence of fire by day, fire by night, cloud by day, and that being our primary strategy of just getting back to an incredibly close relationship and encounter with him. For me anyway, I think that has got to be a priority in church in the next 12 months, is that we begin to show culture in our meetings, in our services, in our discipleship, what it actually means to be a human being, and that's to be in the presence of the Father. And everything that people are longing for and looking for in this moment that's been disrupted is a longing for that thing. You know, I think it was Greg last time I was chatting to you, you said that famous quote from whoever it is that says that, you know, our souls are restless until they find rest in Augustine. Augustine, that's right. That's my prayer. And yeah, I wouldn't want to say I've got the answers to know how to do that, but that's my hope anyway.
Thanks, Jamie. Greg, Kay, have you got anything to add? You're both being kind. Greg,
go first. Okay, sorry. I think, again, there's a danger, we said before, of generalising. Some people make sweeping statements where everybody's been changed or nobody's been changed. And the reality is, I agree with Jamie, that I think a lot of people have been profoundly affected. Most people, I would say, have been profoundly affected by everything that's happened. And I think people's priorities, people I've been talking to, obviously things that I've read, a lot of people have been changed just in terms of you know, what are the things that really matter in life? So, you know, the very foundational things in terms of what really matters, particularly in the light of death. You know, I've not known anyone who's personally died, but we've known a number of friends who've had relatives and people who've died. So England has been an epicenter, hasn't it? Oxford, where I live, has been a pretty much an epicenter of being a very internationalist city. So lots of people have thought about things like that, you know, in the light that this life isn't forever. We live in the illusion that it is. And I think a lot of people have come back to relationships. So I've chatted to a number of people who are guilty because, you know, they realize there's profound suffering out there, but they feel guilty, but they've actually really enjoyed lockdown. My wife is one of those, actually. But there's a number of people I've talked to saying they really enjoyed it. And partly because relationship, because, you know, you've been locked down with, you know, your loved ones, those of us who are in family situations, and they've enjoyed that. So I know other people, numerous people have said to me, how I don't want to go back to the rat race of hardly seeing my spouse, hardly seeing my children. You know, I don't want to go back to how it was. I want somehow to have a pace of life and so on. So, you know, I think people's priorities have been changed, but the cynical part of me is, will it be sustained? And stuff that I read before, you know, to do with a big cataclysmic thing was 9/11. Some of you guys are a bit young to remember that now, but obviously, you know, 9/11 20 years ago, that really shook people up. And, you know, for a time, there were some people being very hedonistic in New York City. Other people, you know, were on a spiritual search or an existential search about life's meaning. But some of the things I've read said that for a lot of people, it was short-lived. So eventually, and it's amazing how quickly New York returned back to normal. And actually those things were forgotten. And I suppose that's the slightly cynical side of me. It would be so easy to actually leave lockdown, and suppose we do return to whatever the normal is, and then actually forget some of these lessons or resolves that we've come to during the lockdown period.
Yeah, I really hope we don't forget these lessons. I just think that's part of the reason we're running this event tonight, is so that we can raise our own questions. But I mean, last night I was so impacted by what Rachel and Chris were saying, that, you know, as I went to sleep, I was just thinking, I really want to live differently. I want to be different as a person because of this. I don't want this to just go past me and back to normal. I mean, our kids aren't back till September, so lockdown's not finishing for a long time in our house, but I don't want to rush on once it has finished. Thanks so much, Greg and Jamie, on that. Becca, do you want to go for the next question?
Yeah, sure. It's Miles again, and I just really enjoyed your question. How can we best breed a culture of joy and blessing in our ability to online church without viewing it unenthusiastically as the weak alternative to physical church? I just like it when there's joy in a question. It's just nice. Greg, I wonder if you've got thoughts on that.
Yeah, can you just flash that up? Yeah. There it is. Have we best breed a culture of joy and blessing in our ability to online church without viewing it unenthusiastically a weak alternative to physical church? I do maintain, I realise it's contentious, you know, that phrase I use about it being impoverished. I don't think it's, you know, but I thank God for it, as I've already said, and, you know, it's one of the great blessings of being alive now in this pandemic rather than previous ones. We can connect, and I think you know the supposition behind the question is that obviously we need to cultivate that enthusiasm for it rather than just seeing it as a weak alternative or maybe a duty where we tick the box. And I think one of the things that the onus is on those of us who are church leaders to actually be creative about how we do it. So I've heard, I realize there's different resources out there and it's not an equal playing field in terms of that, but I've heard stories of small churches who've been incredibly creative about how they've done online church in terms of you know whether it's splitting the sermon up, we've already talked about that, bringing in voices from outside. And I loved, Kay, what you said about, you know, doing that permanently, because at my church we've had so much more, I hate to use the word, lay participation at St Aldate's, where people have been interviewed about, you know, in Oxford there are scientists working on the antidote to the virus. That's the word.
The vaccine.
They didn't work on the virus.
they've been talking about that in the medical culture, the police and things, and, you know, so there already has been bringing people in to our online service. So what you said, Kay, about continuing that would, you know, for people who, for whatever reason, are based in their houses or don't make the physical gathering. So that'd be a wonderful way of continuing to inclusion in the very best sense of the word. But equally, I've heard examples. There was hearing one the other day of a church in Cornwall, where the vicar's just done nothing. It's an Anglican church, And he's literally not even put his sermons online, absolutely nothing. He's not visiting sick or rang anybody. And the church was, I think it was about 50. And they're literally, it's just started. The church is, as in, it's just nothing's happened at all in that church. So those of us who are church leaders, I think the onus is on us to, you know, to pull out all the stock resources that we have to make it as kind of fun as an enjoyable and varied as it can be. And also tying in with the thing that Jamie said, have an expectation of the presence of God. So the thing is, sometimes those of us who are more charismatic churches, we think, oh, well, that's not going to happen now because we can't have, you know, ministry with laying on of hands and all this. But the great thing is that the Holy Spirit, you know, he's not in lockdown, and the Holy Spirit doesn't keep social distancing. And it's perfectly possible, of course, for profound encounters of God, even online. And part of that is expectation. So building in, even in online services, as long as they last, that even though we're in dispersed mode, not gathered mode, we can encounter the living God in our disparate contexts profoundly and in a life-changing way.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
That's good.
Kay, what do you think?
I'm very fortunate in my own church that I've seen an awful lot of joy and blessing with the way that we do church. It's been brilliant. And I feel as if there's an even greater sense of community with them. But keeping that culture of joy and blessing. If I can tell you a story about somebody that I've met who has Down syndrome that started off prayer meetings because he thought, quite rightly, that the backbone of the church is going to be prayer. And he set up that prayer meeting called the Lighthouse. I'm hoping that's still going online. But guys like him bring joy to a room. If you want to raise that joy level, let's go to the people that have actually been the most forgotten ones in the whole of this pandemic with church. Are those young people with learning disabilities? Because their joy is just overflowing. It's catching and it's a blessing. You know, the blessing that came out, the song, which everybody absolutely loved. And I'm sitting on the Additional Needs Alliance watching the comments coming on there about the blessing going, I can't hear it. No one's signing. There is no Makaton. This is not accessible. This is not blessing me. And I say that with huge respect because it's great. What the deaf community has done, and this is a friend of mine that I know is actually listening tonight, instead of going, you awful people, they have blessed a whole community beyond the deaf community by going to the people that made that and saying, can we nick it? And then just put our own signers on. I'm not talking interpreters. These are deaf people signing their own worship.
Yeah, I've seen it. It's great.
It is a joy to watch and has blessed people even further than the original blessing. So there's things like that can actually add a joy to the online church. You know, go and find the one with the 50 countries that are singing Amazing Grace.
Yeah.
That is awesome as well. So it's getting out there and having a look at what's available, but also using those that are under your nose that create joy. But then we're also leading by our own example. If we're sitting there going, I can't wait to get back into church, this is awful. It's like parents setting a really bad example at home when they go home and complain about the worship leader. If we are leading a church, we need to lead with that enthusiasm, but keep our own thoughts here and not actually be just constantly saying, can't wait to get back into church.
Yeah.
Because sometimes we're creating the problem. We need to set the example of joy and blessing.
Great. Yeah, I couldn't agree more, Kate. And I'm amazed constantly how deeply profound online church can be. So I'm glad she's in bed. But my youngest daughter the other day overheard a song. I can't remember which one that she knew. And she shouted out loud, I know that song. And she ran around the house singing the song whilst we were singing it live, because we do Zoom and it's live. She ran around the house singing it, and then she came in, obviously a bit self-conscious, and said, I love it so much, there's water coming out of my eye. She's only five, and she was deeply moved that this song she knew. It was like something of her past she knew, and she was singing it. And what's been amazing for my girls is they've interacted in breakout rooms with adults. We find them just chatting before the service. They've logged on to the laptop on their own. And they're chatting to adults in the breakout room, all people we know, by the way. They love the online worship for adults. And then afterwards, we're the last ones always to get chucked out of online church. They're chatting to our mates.
Amazing.
And I'm just amazed and surprised what God's done in my own family, actually, through online church. Thank you. Let's change tack slightly. We've got a great question from Steve Carmer. Thanks, Steve. Post-lockdown may look differently socially, economically, and politically. Any thoughts on what the church should be doing to prepare for that? Mm. New friend of the Prime Minister, maybe you'd be a good one to start with an answer for that.
Go on then, Greg. Oh, difficult question, isn't it? Thanks, Steve. Yeah, also Steve is pastor of our church. So
and all of them today.
he's getting all the questions and all the difficult ones as well. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, we've got to start thinking carefully, haven't we, about especially economically, how we prepare as you know, the institution and non-profit organizations and charitable bodies, how we prepare economically ourselves, but also how do we help our own communities, and how do we help our own local economy. I think it's, you know, I mean, I was in a meeting this morning with our local authority, Lancaster City Council, trying to flesh out some of those questions ourselves with a couple of guys from our church and some other people from the NHS. And it really inspired by what Chris was saying last night of asking those people, what is it that we can help in our city? How is it that we can contribute? What is it that we can give? Where there are people who are trying to find their way forward economically, how can we be of service? And how can we, you know, repurpose our buildings, which in some senses may no longer be as necessary as we always thought they were, because we are finding that we're doing church more locally, maybe in people's houses or in smaller groups, and more cloud-based online. And the combination of those two things means that big meetings in buildings are perhaps not needed so much, and we could repurpose some of that space from, instead of being our place where we do a 1 hour, 2 hours on a Sunday morning, to something that really serves and is set up to and equipped to serve the community and provide people with something that's going to benefit them socially and economically. So I think we need to start thinking really creatively on those terms and start questioning what it is that we're doing with our resources, and you know, what is our kind of, what is the value for money that we're getting in terms of doing that stuff. You know, I think one of the kind of really shocking things that has recently surprised me from reading Letters to the Church by Francis Chan, you know, he basically says that the bigger church gets, the larger the cost per head is, which is crazy, you know, because all of us think, oh, the bigger the church, the better it is. That's our natural instinct. You know, Chris was saying that last night, go to pastors' gatherings and people are like, how big is your church? And the bigger it was, the better it was. But the reality is, in vast majority of cases, the bigger the church is, the more expensive it is per head. Isn't that crazy? And if we want to be, you know, we need to start asking those really, really big questions about what it is that we're doing in terms of, and what is it that we're going for, and how much has the, I'm kind of going off piste a little bit here, but how much has that progress-driven move towards what is a humanistic vision for society infiltrated the church, where it's all about being professional and doing a really good job and gathering large crowds of people? Because in a way, by dispelling that myth, we actually answer a lot of the questions that we're talking about here tonight, in terms of doing something that's full of joy and celebrates people. Well, if we want to do that, we need to start realizing this whole thing is not a performance, and it's not about doing something professional, because that creates a critical spirit that sucks the joy out of people. And instead, when you allow mistakes and you allow it all to be a little bit messy and authentic and real, that not only saves a lot of money, but it creates a culture of joy. It creates a culture of discipleship, and hopefully that then enables us to start to answer some of these questions of how do we help people socially and economically, partly because we're saving money, but partly because we're hopefully creating environments where people can grow. You don't have to have, like, you know, tattoos and cool shoes in order to be on the stage, or, you know, if you're from a more conservative church, you know, a PhD, but, like, it's for anybody, you know. So yeah, big, that's a broad answer to the question, but yeah, a few thoughts.
Thanks, Jamie. Greg Kay, anyone want to add to that?
Yeah, I mean, I totally agree what you're just saying. Just being able to give that, I can do that. So when you take away the professionalism and you get people going, actually, I think I could do that. And you're actually encouraging people to come out and say, yeah, can I help with that? And that is brilliant. On the socially, economically and politically, I'm going to steer away from the politically. Part of the socially is going to be mental health. Because we're going to have an awful lot of people with post-traumatic stress syndrome, a lot of people where that anxiety is not going to go as soon as they come out of lockdown. It's going to be with them for some time. And that will make us look very different as well. You'll find people that were serving in the past a lot may not feel able to do that. And we shouldn't be just throwing them back into the mix. So we need to be completely aware of that. A lot of people that have had COVID will probably end up, not all of them, but quite a few, are showing signs of ME, chronic fatigue, and that sort of thing. So we need to be building that into the system as well, that we can be there pastorally through all of this. And that means that economically they're going to be affected because they can't work because they're too ill or too, you know, the anxiety is too great. So don't forget that side of it as well.
Yeah, it's been really interesting, hasn't it? Sorry, Jamie, you go.
Greg.
I think it was Greg.
Greg, sorry.
Yeah. Thank you for those insights. That's absolutely key in terms of futuristic thinking. I mean, it's a great question, isn't it? Because I think we're, you know, some people talk about, you know, that it's just obviously returning to the way things were, but it's like three realities, isn't it? Pre-COVID, lockdown, and what we're dealing with now, and then the future. So there's three different realities. And the problem with the futuristic one is nobody knows, fully nobody knows. And so actually you're left with speculation, and that, you know, in any leadership theory, you're asked to speculate, you know, good leaders would speculate different scenarios, you know, A, B and C. But actually there aren't many people doing that in the church. We don't have time to do that often because we're just going from hand to mouth at the present situation. And, you know, so it's difficult to speculate what the things are. But some things we do know, and Kay's mentioned one, I think for as sure as eggs, there's going to be emotional mental health issues. There's a long shadow from this particular pandemic. Three of the quick ones I throw in. One would be the mixed economy of how we do church. I agree with Kay that actually the online thing is here to stay. Like, love it or loathe it, it's here to stay. We've got a mixed economy. And so those churches who are just saying, oh, I'm not going to do that, I think they just need to get with the programme, if at all possible, and actually provide that. The second thing is to do with hardship. You know, we're headed into the biggest recession that any of us have ever known, the biggest recession, some people are speculating, in 200 years. So actually, the church, you know, things that seemed peripheral ministries, perhaps like Christians Against Poverty, peripheral to some people, obviously, those things are going to come more into the fore. You know, the church needs to be known what we believe, but actually for our love, obviously for the demonstration of the gospel, not just the proclamation of the gospel. And so that's an area we really need to get our act together. And the third thing to do, I guess, is to do with apologetics. And so I think apologetics isn't dead. I see it more and more relevant, and particularly what we might call existential apologetics. So when I do university missions now, increasingly I get asked to do existential apologetics. You know, how can I know community in a time of societal fragmentation? Who am I in a society which says that identity can just be what I am, who I say I am? This is existential apologetics. And I think things like that are going to be there. There's going to be those questions, you know, where was God in all this? Where is God in all this? All that kind of stuff. Obviously, the theodicy question, the suffering question, asked in a different guise in terms of the pandemic. And so that's an area we can prepare. So added to Kay's one, I think those three areas there, mixed economy, hardship, and the demonstration of the gospel, and, you know, working on existential apologetics. I think those three areas are dead certs. There's lots that's speculative, but those are dead certs in terms of what the future holds, I think.
Thanks, Greg. That's so helpful. And I completely agree. Community is definitely the new apologetic. My friends are desperate for community. And so for me, being salt and light in COVID-19 is often just hosting Zoom calls for my kids and their friends on a daily basis, or wine and chat on Thursday nights with my mates. And I'm amazed. Yeah. people I've got to know, even random strangers like shouting through our windows saying hello, become friends now. So I think we also have this amazing reason for community. We believe in a God that's Father, Son, and Spirit, the ultimate community himself. I completely agree. I think that's absolutely right.
He's just gone to be with the Lord, the late, great Ravi Zacharias. I think it was Ravi that coined the phrase embodied apologetics. And that's exactly what you mean. You know, we are the apologetic. Yes, obviously he believed in verbal apologetics. He gave his whole life to it. But he also said the need for embodied apologetics, just what you were saying, May, about being there for people, you know, reaching out to the lonely, you know, being mindful of those with disabilities, all that stuff, those who are feel marginalized or feel excluded for whatever reason, and or are vulnerable or in need. We need to be the embodied apologetic to those individuals, as indeed to everybody.
Yeah, well, it's just the scriptures talk about that, doesn't it? It's not as if this is a new thing. It's in the scriptures. It talks about that people would be convinced of God's existence by the community and by the love of the church, which I think is partly as well why some of the stuff that Kay is talking about is so important. It's not just for the sake of including people who find it hard to access church, but that in itself is an apologetic to the world to say, hey, look, we are bound to these people through the blood of Christ, and we love them and we cherish them and we uphold them and honor them. And that in itself is such a powerful thing, let alone the benefits for the individuals involved, you know.
Absolutely.
Amen. That's great. We've been talking a lot about how we can be serving the church. Just have you got any tips for anyone that's a leader here of just how they can be sustaining themselves, protecting themselves, growing their faith rather than just their to-do lists at the start? Jamie, why don't we start with that?
Or go to Greg. I feel like Greg will have loads. He trains people in this sort of stuff. He must have loads of stuff to say. And then I'll fill in everything that Greg misses.
He wants a bit of thinking time.
That's right, yeah.
I would say, if this is particularly geared to leaders, isn't it? How leaders can be nourished.
Yep.
That's right, isn't it?
Yeah.
So I think with leaders, you know, I think it's a principle generally, even pre-lockdown, that sometimes leaders neglect themselves. And at Theological College, where I teach, we do stuff on self-leadership and self-care. And it's so important because it seems altruistic, doesn't it? You can, you know, burn out trying to serve people and you can neglect yourself, which obviously is a complete false economy, because we are called to love ourselves in the best sense, not in a narcissistic sense, but in the sense of appreciate our, you know, the gift of our life that God has given us. But also long-term, we owe it to others who depend on us, or our immediate families, but also the congregations that we serve or whoever it is that we serve. So I think that issue hasn't gone away. In fact, potentially it's been magnified with the situation, because you know, leaders are giving out in a very different way, obviously all you know, online, and the leaders I speak to have got Zoom fatigue, you know, constantly, you know, they're spending all the time on Zoom, and actually sometimes things that is a feeding thing for them isn't as attractive. And I know what it means. So I was supposed to be at a conference earlier today, the College of Evangelists. I think you're in it, Nave, in the College of Evangelists anyway. And they had a conference today. And to be honest, I didn't go to it. And partly I'm busy, but partly I thought, oh, you know, it's not going to be as good online, if I'm honest. You know, as in it's going to be some online speaker. So I thought I've got other stuff to do. And so I think, you know, one of the things I'd recommend to leaders is if right now you don't want online input, or you don't feel you need it, you know, a conference and that kind of thing, and I fully get that, I would say go to your pastor. So I encourage anyone in leadership for them to have a mentor themselves. You shouldn't be in leadership. You shouldn't be a mentor pastor to others unless you yourself are receiving pastoral oversight. So I've got one or two mentors. There's one, I was on the phone to him last night, Rob Scott Cook. He founded a church in Bristol called Woodlands, amazing man of God, prays 4 hours a day. And I rang him up last night. He dispensed his wisdom to me over the phone. He's been my mentor for years and years, and then he prayed for me over online. And so I really encourage that if those are in Christian leadership, you know, Zoom, you know, Skype your mentor right now. You know, turn to people who can speak into your life, you know, accountability, mentoring, whatever. Ask all awkward questions, all that kind of stuff. And if the answer comes back, I haven't got a mentor, then get one. It's like, I don't think it's an optional extra. Having a mentor, pastor figure, whatever you want to call it, is imperative if you're in some kind of upfront ministry, I would say. Has that given you enough time, James? Do you have a thing?
Yeah, but you've covered everything now, Greg. I've got nothing left to say. That's exactly what I was going to say, word for word.
Exactly what I was going to say. Somebody said that.
The only other thing that I would add is to think about, for me anyway, this has been helpful to think about, and we talked a bit about this already anyway, but think about developing spiritual disciplines for using technology. I think that's massively important, because if you've not considered it, then it will consume you. And so it's just stuff like thinking about make your smartphone a dumb phone, turn off your notifications, think about how you use it. What do you do first thing in the morning when you turn on your device? You know, do you need to just pick up the Bible first? You know, those kinds of questions I think are really important to consider. I think in the first couple of weeks, I was overwhelmed by a ridiculous amount of notifications pinging in from all kinds of different places, and it easily gets overwhelming. You need to have a spiritual discipline for technology. Absolutely.
Thanks, Jamie. So I think this is our final question. I'll go to Kay first of all. To what extent do you think the church has succeeded or failed to live up to its calling in lockdown?
Ooh. You could give a different answer from every single branch of the church. Everybody is different. Some areas of the church have really stepped up to the mark. They've been amazing, done loads of things. Some people in the church are sitting there twiddling their thumbs and waiting for the doors to open again, because, church is not church. Some have been arguing about the minutiae of theology whilst people outside are crying out for God. You can go to any single area. So it's a very difficult one to answer. If I talk about my experience from the churches I know and interact with, I've seen just a heart for compassion, a love for the people. And it's been just amazing, really, just to see them. They've been an encouragement. You just repeat the question again, because...
To what extent do you think the church has succeeded or failed to live up to its calling in lockdown?
I think there has been a failure in some areas when you actually look at those that are worst affected by the virus. You know, I live in the East Midlands. I had a look at where the worst areas that have been hit are. They have been the areas where there are the most ethnic minorities, the most needy. And those that are having to go to work that cannot isolate because they have to hold down two jobs just to feed their children. And those churches that are saying, no school. Okay, I get what they're talking about. If I had kids, I wouldn't be sending them back. But at the same time, we've got kids that need to go back because they're not being fed. And there's no one looking out for them. There's no one making sure that they're safe. And that is where the church could step in. Mm-hmm. It's what they used to do before we had a social services department. And the same, I can just add, with shouting out for people with disabilities has not happened. People in the church don't know probably that the Coronavirus Act took away the legal obligation to provide care for disabled people. No one in the church has shouted about that.
Wow.
Bit silence.
Kay, thank you so much. We're really grateful for what you've shared with us tonight, and I hope we can all act upon particularly what Kay said then. Kay, if you can send us links maybe on the Facebook page afterwards and how to respond to that publicly, that would be fantastic. But I just want to say thank you to our panelists, to Jamie, Greg, Kay, for everything. Thank you to my wonderful co-host, Becca. We've really appreciated having your comments and questions. It's just been a great opportunity, hasn't it, to start these conversations. We obviously can't finish them, but we really wanted to raise some of these questions tonight. We'd love you to join in with more events coming up with Community in a Crisis. Next week, we've got an event called Collective Grief and Death in COVID-19, looking at that big question, how on earth do you collectively grieve when you're in lockdown? It's from a Christian perspective, so we'll be opening the gates wide and inviting anybody that wants to come to that. But also through Community Crisis, we're running a survey at the moment to find out what your church online experience has been like. We'd really love you to fill in that survey. You'll find it both on the Facebook page, but also on my blog, naydawson.com. And we'd love to find out what your experience is, both for you as a church member, guests that you brought along, or church leaders. It's for everyone. But thanks so much for coming this evening. If you've enjoyed it, please share it with your friends and keep on commenting on the page for more questions. Thanks a lot. See you again. Bye-bye.
Bye. Cheers, guys. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.